Got it. Here we go. Welcome back, Ursula.
Thank you.
Yes. Running about half a tank. Hopefully Tom got some sleep last night. Tom again! Tom again! Door open.
No, you are. I'll start you are.
I attended the great Rufus Wainwright concert last night in Edmonds. How about you, John?
I went to see David Blaine pull a frog out of his mouth.
So neither of us are prepared.
Did Rufus pull a frog, vomit two frogs from his throat?
No, he did not, I'm happy to say.
Alrighty, here we go. So you got half a tank, I got half a tank.
that's a full tank in my world. It's a Dory Monson show.
You know what? We'll have to pull over and refill with $20 worth of tank.
That's right. Save us some money on that.
Here we go. Story yesterday, Dory Monson went on this one for about 3 hours. Man, he was mad. And I have to tell you something. People listen to our show. And we gave Dory a hard time yesterday. All in good fun. I got a bunch of emails from people saying, hey, we love Dory. Dory's the king. I said, I got it, because we were busting his chops. So we were ahead of him in ratings.
Yeah.
To us, it's no big deal.
Right.
Act like you've been there before.
That's right.
Okay. But I have to say, so yesterday I listened to Dory, and he was legitimately mad. People will say to me often, what is that guy really like? And I said, what you hear on the air, that is Dory's personality unchecked, and he is basically expressing how he feels about the love of this city. So yesterday, the entire show, from what I could hear, was mostly about this rape that had occurred there in Ballot, his hometown. And it caused a lot of people to write to Cairo Radio and also sort of side with Dory and his account that this is just emblematic of a city in decline. Did you get that feeling when you were listening?
Yes. Okay. I didn't hear all the 3 hours, but I heard enough of the tone. I heard the interview with the woman that was attacked in the Green Lake bathroom, and I did hear the interview with the woman at the dealership.
Okay.
I did hear that.
Okay. Any new details that have come out? We know that a woman went to have her car service there at the Subaru dealer, right? Volkswagen Subaru. She goes in. They have a temporary sort of bathroom set up because they're having construction done. A homeless guy goes in with the intent to rape her. He locks the door. He then kicks the stall down. He rapes her. And then I think a number of employees and customers as well come to her aid. They hold the guy. They catch the guy. And police have released a description of who he is, what his name is, and the fact that he is from Texas. And he came here a couple of years ago.
And, again, according to the police, he's already admitted to, yes, indeed, following the woman into the bathroom and admitting to having raped her.
Okay.
And he had his first court appearance yesterday.
Okay. So the question that was brought up by Dory and by others as well is, so the guy had an outstanding warrant. He had gotten some assistance at some homeless camp somewhere, and the warrant was not checked, and maybe the warrant is checked. Or is there any way of being able to follow up on this part of the community? So that's when Hannah Scott joins us with that, because those are the questions that were kicking around yesterday: the police, the warrant, and the homeless.
Yeah, so a couple of different answers here. I talked to Seattle Police, Sergeant Sean Whitcomb, about this, and he says, well, the city does have some sort of relationship with the authorized homeless camps, which this one was. This was the Nicholsville camp. It's in some capacity. They don't usually involve warrant checking.
I can tell you when we're checking someone for warrants, typically, in most cases, it's the product of a detention. So the idea of us checking someone for a warrant, generally speaking, they are being detained by us. They are not free to leave. And so I think that's a little bit different than someone who is seeking or receiving shelter services.
So that basically tosses the ball to the Nicholsville camps or any authorized camps. And what they've said, they sent a statement over to Cairo 7, our news partners, and they are not required by law to do a warrant check on anybody. What they do and what they did do with this particular individual when he entered the camp several months back, they did a check of the King County Transient Sex Offender List, which is focuses on just transient. He was not on there, and that's all they check for. They're not legally required to do any type of warrant check, and they don't, and they never have.
Ah. Okay. So in the city of Sammamish, we passed a law that if you're going to set up a camp like they've done there at Mary Queen of Peace a couple times, you have to have everybody check for all warrant, not just sexual, but warrants as well, any outstanding warrant. And if an outstanding warrant is found on the individual, then the King County Sheriff Department is alerted to that.
Okay, so what happened? So let's play this out. this is, it's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback.
That
this
is our job, say, Tom. Have you seen the bottom of my business card?
Going back. But after all, my guess is there are thousands of warrants out there. And this is a warrant for trespassing.
And actually, I think it's for failure to appear in court on the trespassing.
Yeah. Okay, so the thing is that there are millions of warrants that are going to be checked for minors. I mean, warrant is not like if you're out, you're a suspect in a murder case. They tend to be administrative kinds of things. Now, there are all sorts of signs we might be able to point to in this, but all the we knew on the warrant was, okay, I think it was just for trespassing, but it was a failure to appear in court for not appearing before a trespassing case. So it's not like it's a high priority.
But why not sweep them through?
My guess is, John, a lot of those people in that camp, just like a lot of Seattle citizens or citizens of the state of Washington, have warrants out. What do you then do?
Now, okay. You could have a warrant for a misdemeanor or not appearing. You have a warrant for a parking ticket. You also have a thing called a felony warrant, right?
Okay.
So felony warrant, possession of a firearm or assault, a battery, that type of thing. You get a felony. Now, you want to know about the felons?
That sounds good with
me.
So
in New York State, New York City, actually, the incredibly liberal New York City, they have a thing called the warrant squad. And guess where they go? Homeless shelters. And they run into the homeless shelters at 6 in the morning, and they rabble everybody up, and they go around and get whatever ID they can get, and they sit there and they just run through.
Okay.
Run through. And if it's a misdemeanor on some crap, they let that go. But they're looking for people that have taken a bottle, hit somebody over the head, and raped somebody, and they get those people and they pull them out.
That I'm okay with.
So you're okay with that.
But in this case,
they don't have that here.
That wouldn't have been this. Right now, we see this guy as a rapist.
Right.
And admitted rapist, if we can believe the police. But he wasn't a rapist at the
time. Or himself.
He
admitted to it, right? He admitted to it.
That's
right.
That's what the police report.
According to the police report, he did admit to it.
Okay,
but he wasn't a rapist at the time, or at least we didn't know about that.
Well, he might have raped other people and not been caught.
Well, but might that have. Was, yes, but that's
it's entirely possible.
So
but
I
he wouldn't be
all
caught.
Of us might have raped.
No, Tom. Nope. It's a repeating crime. It's a repeating crime. Is this the first time he's ever raped somebody?
Oh, John, but there was no evidence that he had raped anybody that we knew of. All we knew was that he failed to appear in court for a trespassing charge.
I got it.
In other words, he wouldn't have been caught up in that net.
He wouldn't have been caught in the New York City approach, like you're suggesting.
But that's
all.
How about this? How about you make the distinction between misdemeanor and felony, but you check everybody, especially if you're going to be receiving services from the taxpayer. Okay. It would be nice, and you would be able to catch this guy or some other guy, and you would then be able to get most of the crimes occurred. Now they think they passed this thing in California called Prop 47, which basically took most of these crimes and said, listen, we keep running these people through court, so let's make them all misdemeanors. So you break into a car and you steal something. If it's under $970, it's a misdemeanor. We're going to write you a ticket, right? So what's happened? Crime has skyrocketed in all those places because these guys continue to create misdemeanor charges against them, and there really isn't any way of sort of getting them to run through the system. Tom, what I'm saying is that we have
this has
to do with the fact that we have turned a blind eye to general sense of crime in the city of Seattle, and what you do is get the broken window theory, and now you get more crime, and more crime is evidence. I'm not saying specifically correlation.
We don't have more crime.
We don't have more crime?
I thought Seattle...
Rape has gone up. Robbery has gone down, but rape has increased. In fact, we have a higher rape. We have a higher rape incident occurring here than we do in the rest of the United States.
Okay. Well, overall crime, though, they keep saying it's diminished over the last decade. Nationally, we are more safer now than we were since the 50s. So I don't know what these crime indications you're talking about.
In Seattle, you're talking about car break-ins in 2018.
I'm talking about everything. Crime in general, all the way across the country.
I understand
crime
that
is down. Now, they do have individual blips on, 1 year up and 1 year down.
Yeah. Okay.
But how would we, none of that would have applied here, right? This guy had the failure to appear, misdemeanor warrant for not showing up in court. So even that checking for a felony warrant wouldn't have helped.
Wouldn't have caught him.
Yeah, have caught him. But it's certainly worth a conversation moving forward because you don't know.
Got it. Thank you, Hannah Scott.
You bet.
All right. There she goes. From Texas, by the way. We welcome him from Texas. Came here 2 years ago. The guy that tried to rape that woman in Golden Gardens, he had come from the great state of Arizona. We are able to attract that fine individual. He's, by the way, he's serving some serious jail time.
3 years.
Yeah, or more, I think. They could get him for more. He could be in there for. Let's see. Dozens more charged in the filed probe of the Pacific Northwest Wildlife Poaching Ring. Did you see the long list of the guys that are involved in this thing? the people from the Fish and Game and Northwest Wildlife are like, we don't understand what goes through somebody's head that they'd want to be involved in this type of activity.
Yes, although the one suggestion is, other than what, the kill for thrill idea. Yeah. That's my hunch is what they're doing. They're banding together. These are they have as many as 17 individuals now on two states, Oregon and Washington, mm-hmm. who basically make sport of killing these various animals from bobcat and deer and bear and cougars and even a squirrel. They mentioned it at one point.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of band together. They talk about where they can meet up, where's a good place to do this. They do this illegally. They do not have permits to do this. And for the most part, the carcasses are just left there. They are left to rot. So these are not people that are, you know, killing or hunting for anything other than a kind of illegal sports thrill,
mm-hmm.
because they don't, in general, use the meat. Oftentimes, wildlife agents find the dead deer, you know, headless, and so mm-hmm. they take the head as some kind of a trophy. And they're busting them right and left now. It's the biggest poaching operation they've ever had in this in these two states. And they say even more charges might be coming, but at least 17 people have been implicated at that case. They call it a demented social club. How do they know about this? They know about it because they confiscated. I love this idea. In fact, it freaks me out at the same time. But wildlife agents put cameras up in the middle of the forest because they thought, you know, poaching was going on, and they wanted to see if they could find some evidence. They've got some evidence. They pulled these two guys in a truck over when they saw them the next time. They confiscated their phones and saw all of these pictures of these you know, dead animals as they're posing with them or not and letting them rot,
mm-hmm.
and also a lot of text messages among the various. I think there were 8 charged in one state and you know, a dozen in another state. And the idea is that they were all sort of in cahoots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may have just been buddies bragging with each other, but they were all aware of what they were doing. And according to the authorities, at least, they all knew that what they were doing was illegal. I don't know if the illegality was part of the thrill, but it certainly...
Didn't they say they wanted to change the law so that you couldn't kill so many at one time?
Well, one of the interesting things, I didn't realize this... we have it's a felony.
Multiple animals in quick succession.
Yeah, it's sort of like a serial killer idea if you do it a lot. It's just a misdemeanor in Oregon, and they're talking about jacking up the penalties by calling it a felony, because in Washington State it is indeed a felony if you mm-hmm. kill a lot of animals in a rapid succession. And in illegal circumstances.
I guess it's the thing. You kill a deer for the meat. It's understood that you're taking the life of the deer in order to be able to provide some good from it. But just purely to go out for the sport of killing, although it's the same thing to the deer, just society sort of looks down on it because it doesn't seem to have as much of a purpose or value.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I have difficulties with justifying hunting altogether, but I do understand that from talking to friends who are hunters, they say there is a sense of sport that it's like fair is fair. Now, it's true. Deers don't have guns to shoot at humans.
That would make it fair.
But
or bears.
But the idea is that, you have to sort of respect the law of nature in a lot of ways, and they feel like a true hunter. That's why I know some hunters that feel like you should only do it like with bow and arrow.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, try to level the playing field as much as you can and respect the animals as well. This feels like it's anything but respect.
Or the other one, to make it even more fair, would be that you get some antlers and you duct tape them to your head and you go out there and it's just you against the deer. I mean, you just see what you can do.
The problem is it ended up being you against another guy with antlers on his head mistaking you for a deer.
Possibly. But if you have a problem with somebody going out and hunting and taking a deer and then taking the meat, the venison,
and then
feeding his family with it?
No,
you're okay with that?
I'm okay with that if it's meant as you know, survival idea.
Okay, so he'd have to make a certain amount of money in order to really need the deer meat.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, that's why it's legal, and so we go for it. But
how about freedom?
How about
that he wants to do it?
Well, he might want to kill you, too.
No, that's against the law. That's against the law.
Well, I know. We could make hunting against the law, I suppose, if we wanted to. The question is not whether it's against the law or not. It's whether – how do you feel – the one thing that bothers me about hunters is how the feel of the kill. How do you feel when you kill that animal? And I've had friends who do hunt, and I know they take it very seriously.
Yeah.
They treat it almost like a religion, and they say they have more respect for the animal than most of us do. We just mm-hmm. buy our – you know, ground beef or whatever in a in a grocery store, that I understand that whole aura of it.
Okay.
But just the idea of killing an animal.
So just to get.
Doesn't appeal.
Just to figure out where your prejudice is.
Yeah.
The poor guy needs the meat to feed his family. Okay. The middle class guy goes out and shoots the deer. He doesn't really need the meat because he could just go to the store, but he likes fresh venison.
Yeah.
Do you hold some animosity towards the middle class guy that could feed his family without the venison?
Not nearly as much as I feel toward the rich guy who then pays $10,000 to go on a safari and have the lion rush at him, sort of fleshed out by the natives, so he can shoot it and pose next to it.
Right.
Or like the kind of things that Donald Trump's
sons do. $10,000 is cheap, Tom. I think that's $100,000.
Oh, is that right?
Whatever it is, it's a lot of money. But that money, the $100,000 or the $50,000, $75,000 the guy spends, then goes into the economy there so that a lot of people
supposedly
are fed.
And the justification for it is they use that money to preserve the very animals that they were killing.
Yes.
Because
you got to keep them around. If you didn't, you just wipe them all out, and then you wouldn't make any money from it, right?
Yeah, but if you didn't wipe them all out, you wouldn't need that much preservation or conservation.
Well, they would die. They'd be starved to death, so you're doing them a favor. It's like culling the herd when it comes to deer. I only went hunting twice in my life with my grandfather. I couldn't, because I wanted to be a vet. And I was a big fan of St. Francis. I had a St. Francis statue.
Ah, good
biggest
for
statue
you.
I had.
Really?
And with the snakes and the skunks all around me and a bird on his shoulder,
you know,
a whole thing. I just remember going into the bush with him.
Yeah.
And I had a big shotgun and I looked great. And like a Norman Rockwell painting.
Yeah.
But I just, when the birds came flying up and I saw him take out a whole bunch and you see him sort of flapping around on the ground. I'm like, I missed like three times, and then he said, that's it for you.
Yeah. And it was.
It was it.
And,
I didn't
and
need
your
to do
life
it again.
Isn't any less. Or that.
Well, no, but if I needed to feed my family and I had the ability.
They'd starve.
No, I would go out and get something, like a nice ham and cheese at Subway.
Exactly.
Subway sandwich. All right, we're going to come back. You can write to us at mynorthwest.com. Text as well at 98973. Why it is so hard to ask for help. Asking people to help you actually makes them do something to you that you wouldn't expect. So you should, right now, during the commercial break, ask somebody for help, and what do you see what happens to you? And to them as well. We'll come right back to Tom and Curly Show right here on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM, Seattle's News. Seattle's talk about the news. I think I needed to add that. When I tell people it's a news talk show, they go, oh, so what does that mean? It's news? No. It's news, and then we talk about the news. I'm like, and what do you say about it? Oh, whatever we want. And they pay you for that. Yes, they do. Yep. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Keel Mortgage for all your mortgage needs. They're there for you. This weekend, you're going to go looking for a house. Get yourself a pre-approval letter. Won't guarantee you the home, but lets everybody know you mean business because you're coming in with your Keel Mortgage team behind you. CL 53969, 1-888-778-KIEL. Met a guy on the street yesterday in Seattle, Tom. I was heading over to David Blaine, and he was selling hip-hop CDs.
Uh-huh.
You know I love my hip-hop.
Kendrick Lamar is the worst, you said,
he's a genius.
Ago. And now, a year later,
this guy was not Kendrick Lamar. His name was D-Valley, they called him. So
D-Valley.
I go, I don't have any cash. That's normally my way to get away from people. He goes, oh, you know what? I got Square, what's it called? Square something or other? So with that, he just takes out his phone. He goes, I'll take your credit card. I was like,
gotcha.
Got me. I said, you know what? I like your game. All right, fine. Sweet, bang, $10. He gave me a CD.
Uh-huh.
And I was asking him about, who buys your CDs? I said, you get your brothers helping you out? Got your black guys hooking you up? Nope. Only guilty white guys like yourself. And there you go. So we will be playing his music today.
Yes.
At 10:32 as a bump in. We're going to play track number 2.
Which you have not heard yet?
I don't know. Andrew, did you hear it?
I listened to it.
What'd you think?
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay. Thank you for that. Hopefully he's not listening right now. Track number 2 is the one he told me to play.
Called Try Take Me.
I put $10 into this one. See, we'll see what happens. He had no shame and no harm and no vulnerability asking for help. His help was, hey, can you help me get this CD out there? Can you get people to hear my music? And would you mind donating $10? Oh. So the sense of being able to ask somebody for help, it's often described as vulnerability sounds like truth and feels like courage. Truth and courage aren't always comfortable, but they are never weaknesses, Tom.
Okay, but they feel like weaknesses.
Yes, they do feel like weaknesses.
We have two sort of countervailing opinions about asking for help. So let's start with this first one. Why is it so hard to ask for help? The answer is blame evolutionary psychology. This one article talks about they did this experiment. This is a Stanley Milgram who did a lot of the Stanford experiments about how much people are willing to punish others if they feel like they're told by a higher authority that they have the responsibility to do that. That's neither here nor there. In this case, he said that they did this study where he had graduate students go onto the New York subway and then ask people to give up their seat for them so they could sit down. And they said they reported back that the students said that they felt traumatized by the experience. And why is it? I felt like I was going to throw up. I just felt so, how can I do this to somebody to ask for that?
Right.
And they said that, what was it? And the prof was a little skeptical. So the prof said he did it too. And he says, yeah, he found himself getting all sweaty hands and stuff. He says, we have a physiological reaction to asking a favor of somebody. Now, it might be because they didn't need the favor.
That's
or they didn't
it.
Feel like they had the right to the favor.
Right.
But he says, in this particular case, people really hate asking somebody for help. So the speculation here is, so why is that? And he goes back to evolutionary psychology establishes that we are members of a tribe. Mm-hmm. And we realize, especially you think back in the caveman days.
Let's go 3 million years back.
You need support of your family and your tribe just to survive.
Sure.
You know, sort of a comfort in numbers. And so anytime when you ask for help, you are risking expulsion from that tribe.
Uh-huh.
That you are you're in danger of losing status. You have the fear of the fear of being treated unfairly. You feel of uncertainty and the fear of rejection. All these things work into the system. No, I don't want to make myself vulnerable, because if I make myself vulnerable, people may say, "Oh, you're a drag on our tribe."
Sure.
Out with you.
Can't pick up the rock. You got to go.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So that everybody understands that part of it.
Yes.
Right. And I've often heard it said that altruism or the idea of helping one another is genetically encoded within us. If it wasn't, then we would have ceased to exist a long time ago.
Okay.
That we will help people. You see somebody down on the ground, because so many people have cell phones, everybody's got them, the number of 911 calls have escalated. Somebody on the side of the road, you might see somebody slow down if they can safely and ask if you need any help, right?
Yes.
People want to help. It makes you feel good to help. That's the part of the equation that people don't realize.
That's
right.
The
second part of this study.
And the second, so this is a different study, though, and this is something called the Ben Franklin effect. Story goes back to Ben Franklin knew he had somebody out in the public eye that just really hated him.
Yeah.
And so the way he decided to approach that is he contacted him and asked if he could borrow a book of his.
Mm-hmm.
The guy said he was flattered by the fact that Ben Franklin, a guy he thought he hated, would ask for a book of his. So he gave him the book. After a week, Ben Franklin read it and then gave him a nice thank you note after that. And he says, and they became lifelong friends.
Uh-huh.
They said, how is that? That he asked for asked a favor and got the favor in return. And the suggestion here is that if someone is willing to ask you, in effect putting himself in a weaker position vis-a-vis you and asking for your help, you then all feel magnanimous and, oh, yes, he needs my help.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel better about not only yourself being so generous, but also you have a better idea. You have a more positive feeling about the guy who asked you for that effect. Now, the one interesting wrinkle about this is they said that there's a kind of cognitive dissonance that if I hate John, but then John was, you know, asked me for a favor and I gave him the favor, how do I justify giving him a favor if I hate the guy? Oh, I must not really hate him. He must be a nicer guy. And so you allow your positive feelings to overwhelm your negative feelings, and that's the Ben Franklin effect.
I can tell you that the brain releases a certain amount of dopamine when you do a favor for somebody.
Yeah.
And it seems like you get even more if you do it for a stranger. Huh. I have seen, driving with the kids in the car, I always say, look for God. They look for an opportunity to walk with God. So you might drive down the road and see somebody with the cars that stalled in one lane, right? And the guy's in the car and you can tell he's got the flashers on. I said, guys, look, here's God. We got a chance. We got a chance to walk with God. Hold on. So you pull aside. Come on, man. We'd safely cross the road, go up to the side of the car. We've done this many times.
Yeah.
You need a push? Oh, my God, yeah. I said, okay, you steer and just we're going to get you over and get you off the road. And when you get out of the car, you see other people get out of cars and everybody joins in and pushes the guy off the side of the road. And then you're like, hey, you get back in the car. And, hey, life is great.
Exactly.
Life is great. Guys, how about that? And they're always like, why are you so excited? I said, don't you see what we did? The guy had troubles, and then everybody else jumped in. When we jumped in, it gets a great feel.
So, and to capitalize on it, to bring these two studies together, in that study where they talk about evolutionary psychology has made it such that we feel awful when we ask, they say that they did these experiments that most people, like, I don't know, 75 or 85% of the people that you asked the favor for not only gave you the favor, they felt good about giving you the favor.
Right.
So really, we ought to get over this evolutionary psychological fear. Oh, I'm going to put myself in a weakened state by asking a favor. Ask a favor. You not only your fear of rejection will not come to pass.
But let's not push it.
Let's
not push it all the way. I mean, there's a certain point where someone's asking for too many favors.
Okay.
And I think people have like a limited amount of favoring that they will do.
If every
your neighbor's always coming over, hey, I bought that chainsaw. Hey, that one I saw in the backyard over there. Hey, you got a weed whacker? Eventually at some point you're like, you know what? Why don't you get your own tools?
John, there are no limits to true generosity.
No, there is when you feel like people are taking advantage of you.
Yes, and that is what we're afraid of when we're putting ourselves in a weakened state. We got to get over that, John.
I tell you, this is a crazy story. 2 minutes. So Craig and Paul, two friends of mine, both one was a flight attendant, died in that 261 airplane crash, right, in Alaska Airlines. They move into a neighborhood up near Capitol Hill. No, Columbia City. They see an old woman. She's got her, looks old. She's got her head in a bandana, and she's coming into the house, and she's teetering. He comes over. Craig comes over and says, hey, excuse me, we're your new neighbors right over here. If you need anything, let us know, because they assume she had cancer because she had her head shaved. So then she says, well, I could use some help with my garbage every Thursday. So then they would bring her garbage in. Do you need anything else? Well, we're going to the store. You want us to get something. So then they eventually work this woman into their life where they were picking up her things for her. They were cleaning her house. They were taking her garbage in. They were cutting her grass. One day, the daughter is coming out of the house, and Craig or Paul, I can't remember which one, said, hey, I'm going to ask you something. How's your mom feeling?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Well, her cancer. Oh, my God. My mom told you she has cancer. God, I hate that. Question. Do Craig and Paul stop taking in her garbage?
No.
Absolutely not. And their thinking was, when they told that story, everybody's like, oh, screw
scam.
Her. You got burned.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, she has a deeper and sadder sickness than cancer.
See, that's great.
I know.
That's a big heart. Oh, true generosity.
They're great people. Too bad. They're no longer with us. I assume someone like that is in a special place like heaven. Take a quick break. We'll come right back. With teenagers, was it in the state of Washington they were asked this question?
That is correct.
Yep. They say they drive better with this.
Because it's legal in a lot of circumstances.
Don't give it away. Just gave it away.
No, I didn't.
My tease was so much better. Hold on. Listen up. Ignore that. The jury will strike that last comment from Tom. How about these Washington State drivers, these teenagers, Tom? They said they do better because of this.
It's illegal?
Shoot. Alrighty, here we go. It's Tom and Curly. Show right to us at mynorthwest.com. Text as well at 98973. As we admitted at the very beginning of the show, Tom and I like to hold anything back from you guys. We appreciate the honesty that you give us in our letters, and we thought we'd share with you. Tom was out late last night. I was as well. Didn't get in until 10:30, quarter of 11. And then what time did you get in?
11:30.
Yee boy. Wow. All right. So we're both on half tank, but it's a combined one full tank. It's all you need to knock these stories down. How about the fact that teens in the state of Washington were asked, hey, you ever drive high? Ever drive drunk? Or you ever drive sober? How do you do when you're driving under the influence of the marijuana?
Well,
if you want to make something seem like you're an old man, put the word "the" in front of it.
Son of a gun.
Huh?
Cannabis, the cannabis.
Yeah, there you go. That's better.
Doesn't make you a better driver.
What?
If you're a teen and you think like a teen,
yeah,
this is not the case, but they say this is a disturbing development. Right now, obviously, because marijuana is legal in this state under certain circumstances, that more people are abusing it in more creative ways. And one of them, unfortunately, is that people are not texting and driving. They're smoking and driving, and it is not making them better drivers. And the danger with that is that for some reason, because they think, I don't know, what the one, my one disappointment about this particular article is it doesn't say why they think that. I was thinking maybe they claim that they feel like they're more relaxed, or maybe they're just this idea you were suggesting that, well, since things seem to slow down.
They slow down.
Yeah. Then maybe they figure, okay, well, if I'm going 5 miles an hour, how dangerous can that be?
It is true.
But it could be dangerous if you're on a highway. anyway, but yeah, that's just the kind of, this is a.
You see them on the roads now.
Yeah?
You do. You see them, and I asked a cop if he's noticed it in the last year. He said, what you see is you see more people hesitating at green lights, and they're not necessarily on the phone. Slower, just slower reaction time, and driving slower. You see them driving slower on the highways. Yeah. And it's not some old guy, you know, in an Impala or somebody in an RV. It should be somebody that should be speeding.
Yeah.
But they're not.
So are we better off? Do we want our teenage drivers, our bad teenage drivers, speeding or slowing down because they're high?
Given the Hobson's choice between an intoxicated teenage driver, I'd rather have them high on marijuana, the marijuana.
Okay.
After watching the Johnny Carson show, then drinking.
Oh, then drinking.
Drinking makes you drive like a crazy person.
Okay, now this, that's an interesting. They don't get into that much, but yeah, in terms of the driving sins, what's a bigger sin?
Yes,
they're all sins, John. They're all mortal sins.
I know, Tom, but again, you'd rather have the guides.
Yeah, no. I think that's an interesting distinction. I wonder if a highway patrol thinks the same.
One of the interesting things we don't have time to get into the sound on is that the National Institute of Drug Abuse has done studies on what the equivalent ratios of pot in your system to alcohol are.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't find that it causes you to have risk-taking behaviors, like speeding, for example. But you can equate the swerving in the lanes, and your ability to stay in the lane is the equivalent of alcohol. So you might not be speeding everywhere, but you can't maintain your lane control the same way that you can when you're drunk.
Huh. I remember a time, this was illegal, it was in the early 80s, and it was in New Jersey. And we went to this professor's house that I had met, nice guy, and smoked a big, great big joint. And then I had to drive back to Philadelphia. But it hit me as we started to drive. And I turned to my girlfriend at the time, and I said to her, I said, I got to be honest with you. I think I'm too high to drive. I'm too high to drive. And we had just left his house. We had 195 miles to go. We had just left his house. She goes, that's okay. If you're too high, I'm not high at all. So I could take over and drive for you. I said, well, that's a huge relief. And she goes, but why should I bother doing that? Aren't we almost there? And I realized, oh, my God, she's higher than I am. Now we're all alone.
She's like these teens that think marijuana makes them better drivers.
Right-hand lane.
We're already home.
Jersey Turnpike, 27 miles an hour with the hazards on the whole way. White-knuckling it, Tom. Oh, kids, don't do that. Don't do that.
Don't do either of them.
Don't do any of that.
Especially not both together.